listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. If you have a question about your animal's behavior, give us a call right now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. In addition to the calls, we've got a great topic to share, right, Patricia?
We do. It's really interesting. You know, in 1994, the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control reported that there was an average of about 4.2, 4.5 million dog bites every year.
Ouch. That's a lot. That's a lot.
That is a lot. And we've mentioned that number on the show. I've used that number before, but there's a new book out that adds a new perspective to this statistic. So later on in the show, we're going to look at that statistic and talk about why we might want to look at it a little bit more carefully.
A little more about statistics and animals a little later on. And we'll also take a look at the history and significance of the pigeon with author Andrew Blackman. But before we get to that, we have some callers waiting to talk to us. So let's go to those phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
My name is Barbara.
And where are you from, Barbara?
Martinsburg, West Virginia.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you. What can we do for you?
Well, I was listening, I guess, 2 weeks ago, and I caught the tail end where you were helping a lady who said her kitty cats were biting her toes in the middle of the night.
Right.
And you gave her some suggestions what to do to keep them from waking her up in the middle of the night, because mine like to do that to me, too. So I have four of them, and they pick different times, and they want different things, so I need a little bit of help.
Yeah, you know what? We forgot to mention, as a piece of advice, steel-toed boots when you're sleeping.
Sleeping in your boots. Dr. Mueller's advice.
They don't bite my toes. They just scratch at my bedroom door until I get up, and I get up, and I'll either let them out or do whatever so that they'll stop. So.
And that's the key. There's the key. They scratch at your bedroom door until you get up. And this is so easy to do. And it's so easy to say, you just need to stop getting up.
Right.
And doing whatever they need to do. It's so easy to say it, and I'm the first to recognize that it's a lot harder to do. I have a cat. I have four dogs. I totally understand. But the fact of the matter is there's no way around it. If the cats learn that if they just scratch long enough, you'll get up and give them what they want, then they're never going to give up. It's one of the basic principles of learning is that if an animal gets intermittent reinforcement, in other words, sometimes you get up and sometimes you don't, it's actually the best way to keep them doing what you don't want them to do. So you have a couple of choices. One is you just bite the bullet, and for 3 weeks or so, and it usually is going to take about that long, 21 to 28 days to change a habit.
Okay.
If you just bite the bullet and just put a pillow over your head and ignore them for maybe 3+ weeks, usually that behavior will extinguish. Now, every once in a while, there's an outlier. There's a cat who didn't read the psychology book, didn't take it in college, and will keep trying for 6 weeks or so. But most animals will give up after somewhere between 3 and 4 weeks. So
okay.
That's one thing to do. The other thing you might want to do is think about, why are they always getting up at night? Now, we know cats are nocturnal. Just if you look at their wild type ancestors, we've talked about them, Larry, right? African wild cat, they tend to be nocturnal. So all of us are fighting the fact that kitties are just, wired a little differently than we are. So you might want to think about, well, what do my cats do during the day? How can I get them busier so they'll sleep a little bit more at night? Maybe get them all very, very active. Early in the evening, not late in the evening, because just like kids, if you get exercise too late, it gets hard to sleep. You just get too revved up. So you can think about that. You can also think about the temperature. If it's a little colder, sometimes cats get a little more like when they want to cuddle up. Maybe you want to have a heated sleeping place for them outside of your bedroom, so they're like, oh, it's a little chilly in the house, but if I curl up on this little thing and nap, I'll be very cozy.
Keep your house temperature down around 40.
You're right.
I never thought about them wanting to snuggle because of heat, because I don't really keep it super warm in my house. So that is a possible reason for them wanting to come in there with us.
Yeah, maybe they want to get warm. So make them some nice, wonderful, cozy beds outside of your bedroom. So there you are. Keep your house at 40 degrees and wear steel-toed boots and body covering.
Thanks.
And aren't you glad you called?
Yes. And I have another really quick question for you.
Okay.
I had heard that orange cats were male cats and calico cats were female cats. Is it true that all orange cats are male? Does their genetics come out that all orange tabbies will turn out to be male cats?
If it's true, I need to have a very long discussion with my cat, Sushi, who is a female orange cat.
Okay.
So that pretty well answers that question, right?
Thanks, Barb. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. If you'd like to join in, here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. Got an email question from Amy in Palm City, Florida. Patricia, she has three dogs. One's an 8-year-old Bichon. She's got a 6-year-old Beagle, a 4-year-old Dachshund Terrier mix. And she wants to know how she can tell which dog is the pack leader. She says the leadership, it seems to change from time to time. Is this normal for a group of dogs living in a human home?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question because it's very normal. And the fact that that seems surprising to us is based on a misunderstanding often of what social status, dominance, submission, what that actually is. You know, all social status means is that the individual who has the highest status has the most social freedom. I mean, I think that's the easiest way.
Oh, it's a good way to put it.
To put it. And we all can recognize that. You go to a lecture, for example. Say you're going to talk by a physician about heart health or something, and she is up on the stage speaking. Who has the most social freedom in that room? Not you in the audience.
No, she can wander all over the place.
Exactly. She can do anything she wants. She can walk down in the audience. She can do anything she wants. So status is about social freedom, and dominance specifically relates to if there's a limited but prized resource, like, say, a bone, in between your three dogs, who's going to get it without having to fight for it? Because that's what social status and dominance is about. So it's very common for a group of dogs to sort of trade off who does what. So you might get one dog who goes out into the backyard first every single time. Say your old Doxie goes out into the backyard first every single time. But yet it's another dog who would be the one who got the bone. Well, it might be that your Doxie, that the Doxie cares most about going to the backyard first, and the other dog, they don't care that much. You know, one of the things about pack leaders, it's not as if they get every single thing first all the time. Life just
doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that way. So that physician speaking up on the stage, she might open the door for you. You know, if she took you to lunch or you took her to lunch or something like that. It's just much more complicated than that. And the other thing to keep in mind is that dogs may be derived from wolves, but they're not wolves. And my speculation, and that's what it is that social status is less important. It's still relevant to dogs, especially in dog-dog interactions. But I think it's less important to dogs than it is to wolves. Otherwise, they'd act more like wolves. And, you know, if they did, we wouldn't have them in our living rooms.
All right. Great answer. If you have a question, by the way, you'd like to email in, Patricia, how do they do that?
Oh, we love to hear from you. Please just email us some ideas or a question. Send it to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to call, the number is 1-800-462-7413. And someone else online, let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name's Joel. And I'm from Portland, Oregon.
Joel, thank you very much for calling.
All right, I have a couple of dog questions for you.
Sure.
I have two dogs, and one is a Border Collie mix, Border Collie Spaniel, and the other one is a Golden Retriever with maybe like a Llewellyn Hound mix or something
okay,
like that.
Okay, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. You know, we kind of guess. And mostly it's about the Golden Retriever mix. When we're walking on leash, and I usually have the two of them together. If we come up to another dog, they get really, really excited. And then if I don't control them, then he does a bark and lunge kind
okay.
of thing.
Okay.
It's very excited. But it doesn't seem to. And if he makes it to the other dog, then he pauses, and then his tail's wagging, and there's the pause, and then a play bow.
Okay.
And then the other dog kind of gets confused and doesn't really know what to do. And if there's an interpretation, it seems that the dog thinks that my dog is weird or something like that.
Well, you might be thinking your dog is about to attack, but then the dog does a play bow.
Yeah. And because it's a play bow, it doesn't elicit the same response from the other dog that a really aggressive behavior would. And I've been trying to work him out of it, but I don't know. He seems to get very, very excited when anybody or any other dog comes near, to the point where he loses control of himself.
I went to a fight and a hockey game broke out. That kind of, you know, that happens to dogs too, is they get so emotionally aroused, they just sort of lose control and end up doing strange things. And sometimes that just morphs into aggression, especially when you add it on to frustration. And I think that might be part of what's going on with your dog. I think there's several things going on. One has to do with the fact that when we are walking down a sidewalk with dogs on a leash, greeting someone else walking towards us on a sidewalk with a dog on a leash, we are actually forcing our dogs to greet each other in a situation in which all dogs would avoid at all costs if they possibly could, if they were free. It forces an unnatural situation which is actually very threatening and potentially elicits aggression. Dogs go way out of their way to avoid meeting each other sort of head on, like us primates like to do. Also, because dogs are on leash when they're greeting other dogs, I think very often they get frustrated. They get excited, as you're saying. They get very excited. Yeah. And then they get frustrated. And as we know, excitement and frustration can morph into something that feels like and might look like aggression. So my guess is that the reason other dogs are confused by your dog is because your dog is emotionally confused in that he is feeling all kinds of different emotions. He's sort of ambivalent, and there's a push-pull going on there. I'm teaching my dog, Will, a cue that I say, watch me.
Right.
And so first I taught him, when I say watch me, I want you to turn around, whip around 180 degrees, and look right at me and come towards me, and if you do, I'll give you a treat. So first I taught it with no other dog anywhere. It was just, watch me. He'd be looking somewhere else, and there's no big distraction. He's in the living room or the garage or something, and I'd say, watch me, and he'd turn around and look at me, good boy, and I'd give him a great treat. So I got that so it was mastered, so I could say watch me with no distraction, and he would, you know, there'd be a sonic boom when he turned around. He'd turn around so fast. And so then I started doing it when he saw another dog, but I always was careful to make sure the other dog was a very, very long way away. And then gradually what you're going to do, phase three, is you're going to start asking him to do that as he gets closer and closer to other dogs. So eventually he'll get within, say, 3 feet of another dog, you say, watch me, he turns and looks at you. And then you can just sort of walk parallel to that other dog and avoid all that tension of that greeting ritual, which adds just all kinds of angst to a lot of dogs. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Good. Give it a try, and I'll let you know how I'm doing. You let me know how you're doing.
Thanks very much for calling. By the way, how is that Will doing, that new dog of yours?
Oh, my Will. Well, he is absolutely phenomenal with people. He's just like his Uncle Luke. He just adores everybody. Larry, he'd be so happy to meet you. But he is afraid of unfamiliar dogs. And he's been that way ever since he was tiny. So I'm doing all the things I tell everybody to do. I'm working really, really hard on it. And I'll keep you posted.
Good. Keep us posted. And you can join in and keep us posted on your questions as well at 1-800-462-7413. Coming up, we'll find out how prominent and serious dog bites really are. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Time for this week's topic. And, Tricia, we've talked a bit in the past about an estimated 4.2 to 4.7 million dog bites that occur each year, but you're saying that maybe that statistic isn't valid after all.
Well, you know, I always assumed that because it came from a very credible source, the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control, that it was a very solid figure. But, you know, I read a book recently titled Dogs Bite, But Balloons and Slippers Are More Dangerous, written by Janice Bradley, and it really got me thinking about that particular figure.
Well, what's wrong with that figure?
Well, Here's some things to think about. First of all, there was a small sample of people who were asked if they knew of a dog bite, not if they'd been bitten, but if they knew of a dog bite occurring any time in the last year. Now, there's a big potential problem with that because people aren't very good at remembering when a particular event occurred.
I did some research where we interviewed people and then re-interviewed them 8 weeks later,
uh-huh.
the same people, and I was struck by how many people said, you know, when we talked to you a year ago, it was just 8 weeks.
Really?
So they really did not have a very good concept of the length of time.
So, you know, people could be reporting something that happened in the last 2 or 3 years or just the last 6 months. So that's a little problematic.
Was there any accounting for the seriousness of the bites?
Larry, that's a really good question, because I think that's one of the keys that we need to be looking at. Of these estimated 4.2 or 4.7 million dog bites, 83% of them actually cause little or no injury at all. And that's the same as reporting statistics on how many kids scratch their knees on the playground and then reporting that as a serious health problem.
Well, how can we get a better idea or better data on these dog bites if these research methods aren't accurate enough?
Well, you know, it's a really good question, because this is something we do need to be looking at here.
Sure.
Well, here's one thing you can do, and this has been done. You can look at data from emergency rooms. Emergency rooms in hospitals take good, clear, detailed records, right? So there's some good, solid data there. And here's what we know from, well, here's 1 year where we have some good statistics from 2002. We know that in that year there were over, now this is a lot, there were over 340,000 dog bite injuries presented. Well, that's a lot,
okay.
Right? And that seems pretty high. However, if you compare it with the other types of injuries that were presented, it doesn't quite seem so high anymore. First of all, over 2 million people went to emergency rooms because they cut themselves with some kind of a sharp object. And almost 8 million people went to emergency rooms because they fell down. You know, they had kind of a serious fall. And I think what's most important, and this is very interesting, the psychology of this is interesting, the injuries that were suffered by, for example, falling down or cutting oneself were far more serious than most of the dog bites that were brought to the emergency room. Only 1% of the dog bites that actually came into the emergency room were over what emergency rooms call level one, which is the lowest, just what you'd think, the lowest level of injury. Whereas the average level of injury for a fall or a cut was level three.
Okay, so you're not saying that dog bites really aren't a problem, are you?
Yes, of course I'm not. I would never say that, you know, we don't need to worry about dog bites. Yeah, absolutely every single bite is a problem, and I think we should be doing everything we can to prevent it. But I have to say that given how much exposure that we all have to dogs, frankly, I think sometimes it's a miracle that there aren't more. So I think the bottom line here is that we need to be very careful about talking about, as some people do, about a, quote, epidemic of dog bites. I've heard that a lot lately, Larry.
Yeah.
So, epidemic of dog bites. Dog bites have increased. I'm not so sure the statistics really support that. I do think what's important is that we prevent all the dog bites we possibly can. We need to increase educational efforts about how to handle and train dogs. A lot of dog bites, whether serious or not, could be prevented. And we also need to be breeding dogs for qualities that make them docile and safe and loving companions.
Okay, so Janice Bradley could well be right here, or is right. Dogs bite, but balloons and slippers are more dangerous.
She makes a really good point. It's worth looking at more carefully.
Here's something else worth considering. Our phone number, 1-800-462-7413. If you want to join in, we'd love to hear from you. And let's take another call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, Larry and Patricia. This is Lauren from Washington, D.C.
Lauren, pleasure to speak with you. What can we do for you?
I really enjoy the show, and I have a question about the saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks.
Okay.
I have a 10-and-a-half-year-old Dalmatian who is truly a lifelong learner. She is always changing her behavior in response to new family schedules, and her vocabulary especially is always going up. And an example of this would be, I think a lot of people have dogs who figure out what vet means, and they cower in the corner anytime anyone says it.
Right.
So after she figured that out, which was a long time ago, we started saying V-E-T. And after a while, she figured out that V-E-T spelled vet.
Right.
And we had been through countless formulations so that she wouldn't refuse to go out the door and get in the car. And we're now on this Harry Potter-esque kind of thing where we say, that which must not be named. And so far, she's not gotten that one, but I'm sort of expecting that she might. But the best example of this I have is breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Long time ago, she realized that means the little kids are going to come to the table and they might drop something on the floor, so I better get in there fast. So she comes to the table at a run from wherever she's in the house, anytime anyone says even casually those three words. Not long ago, I went back to work, and we got a Spanish-speaking-only nanny to come in the house. And within literally 2 weeks, she had figured out that desayuno, almuerzo, and cena also meant breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and she would do the same thing.
A bilingual dog.
So now I have a bilingual Dalmatian, and I'm wondering whether there's any truth to the idea that dogs get set in their ways like old people, or whether we're actually underestimating them.
Well, I love that you asked this because, you know, it's such an interesting phrase. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. You know, usually people don't use it in relation to dogs, right?
No.
They use it in relation to people. But I think in this case, I think it's important to link the two of us together because I think the same basic perspective carries over both species, which is that it's really good for the brains of old dogs and old people to continue to be used. Dogs can learn anything as long as their brains are working even sort of at half speed, just as humans can. And we know, you know, the evidence from the medical profession is overwhelming that the more humans exercise their brains and learn new things, the better it is for them. You think of your brain almost like an organ. And I don't see why that wouldn't be true for dogs. Absolutely, you can teach old dogs new tricks. I mean, Larry and I are both old dogs, for heaven's sakes. I was a freshman in college when I was 30, for heaven's sakes, and didn't get my PhD till I was 40. So absolutely, old dogs can learn things, new people can learn things, and all the better for both of them.
Well, I see it every day, and I hope I'm as quick at 70 as she is at 10.
Yeah, she's an inspiration, isn't she?
Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call very much. Smart dog, too, though.
What a great story, yeah.
Here's the number for you to call, 1-800-462-7413, and here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Tanya in Reston, Virginia.
Hello, Tanya.
Hi, how are you?
Doing just fine, and how are you?
Great, great. We have kind of a different question for you. My son, Connor, who will turn 4 shortly, has inherited a fantail goldfish last September. This goldfish, we named it Lula. We have no idea if it's male or female. She's a hand-me-down fish from a friend who moved away. And we're guessing she's approximately 2 years old. She's about, an inch and a half, 2 inches long.
Okay.
We have her living in a 2-gallon fish tank. She has a treasure chest in there that my son bought her to play with.
Good.
And the bottom of the tank is a gravel mixed with marbles, just to make it look colorful. It's like a blue gravel with some green marbles.
Okay.
And we have some sinking fantail fish food that we were given to feed the fish, and she does just fine with that.
Okay.
However, we've noticed every day, almost every day, in the afternoon when my son and I are in his room, the fish is in his room, Lula seems to be playing or something with these marbles. She is knocking them with her nose, and it's always midday when he's about to go down for a nap. And at first we thought it was kind of funny. Mm-hmm. But now we think it is sort of peculiar fish behavior. She's not being fed at that time necessarily. And from what we could see, there's no food or anything underneath these marbles. She just seems to be moving them with her nose.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not sure why she would do this.
Well, you know, one, this is just pure speculation because that's all we can really do is guess. But one thing to keep in mind is that a lot of fish lay eggs in nests on the ground. Now, I don't know exactly how goldfish, whether they're a nesting species or not. I don't think they are.
I don't think they are.
I should know this, darn it, because goldfish are so popular. But so that's one possibility is nesting behavior, if it would relate to her species. It's also very possible that she really is doing something akin to playing. These are fish that often are quite social. You often find them in large groups. And, you know, what does she have to do? Right? She doesn't have to look for food. So she well might be just stimulating herself, entertaining herself. I'm perfectly comfortable calling that play.
Mm-hmm.
You can teach fish all kinds of tricks. You can teach them to go through hoops.
Really?
Yeah. You can teach. I've seen a fish that basically was trained to do a little underwater agility course, like a dog jumping over things and through tunnels. And you could get your children really involved in a really great kind of a science/pet project and teach the goldfish to go through a hoop, to go into a tunnel, to move one piece of rock from one place to another. I don't know why not. It would enhance the welfare of the fish, and it would probably teach your kids a lot.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. We are going to have a little fun with Lula the fish.
All right.
All right. Thanks, Tanya. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, our number. You know, New Yorkers call them rats with wings, and in Montreal, they're known as flying ashtrays, believe it or not.
Yuck!
But pigeons weren't always considered filthy pests, and coming up next, we'll hear about the fascinating history of these everyday birds. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers online archives of the show, pet tips contributed by other listeners, and a complete list of guests featured on the program. Our website is callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Also, the radio store provides a selection of books and training guides featuring advice to deal with multi-dog households and leaving pets home alone. Information and ordering at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week, we welcome Andrew Bleckman to the program. Andrew is the author of a new book called Pigeons, The Fascinating Saga of the World's Most Revered and Reviled Bird. And he joins us today to talk about it. Andrew Bleckman, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
You write that pigeons have been revered throughout most of history, but that they've recently become reviled. Why is that so, and what's changed?
Well, you know, not a whole lot has changed, except for the way we view them. Pigeons have been our best friend, really, for about 10,000 years. They were domesticated right around the same time, or just after, the dog was domesticated. And, in fact, they were worshipped as fertility goddesses. Noah's dove was a pigeon. They were used by Solomon, Caesar, Hannibal, all to carry messages by their armies. And then what I can attribute it to is in the past 50 or so years, our society's become increasingly, obsessed with hygiene is what I would say. And the pest control industry has really taken advantage of that and portrayed the bird as a venomous rat. And that really isn't the case. It is wildlife, but it carries no more diseases than you or I do.
Now, there's a small segment of the population that still does revere pigeons, right? People still show them?
Absolutely. In fact, you might be surprised to hear that the Queen of England is amongst that group. That minority. She races pigeons, and her father did, and her grandfather did, as well as Mike Tyson is among that group. He keeps pigeons as well. There's all sorts of communities of folks who really, really appreciate the bird. There's the folks who run around the streets of New York City trying to protect them from injury. There's folks who show them off at beauty pageants, much like the Westminster Dog Show, except for you don't have the leashes and the jumping around on the tiptoes. And then you have folks who race them as well. These birds are really capable of unbelievable athletic feats. For example, the racing pigeons typically fly 600-mile races at 60 miles an hour.
And that's amazing.
They're not stopping for food, water, or rest, or anything. And they're flying from a place they've never flown before. By comparison, a horse, the very, very best, will sprint for about 40 miles an hour at maximum around a closed track for a little over a quarter mile.
Oh.
pigeons, I know one of the things you write about is that pigeons played a tremendous role in the world wars, right? Would you tell us more about that?
Well, you know, 1 million pigeons. This is hard to believe, but 1 million pigeons served in World War I and World War II. And they saved thousands thousands of soldiers' lives. People often ask me about Cher and Me, which is just it's an unbelievable story. It was World War I. And the soldiers, it's the trench warfare, and our soldiers, American soldiers, were behind enemy lines. They got caught back there. They were called a lost battalion. Now, they were getting decimated by the enemy, and then things got a lot worse. They were being pummeled by our own artillery, who didn't realize where they were. Now, back then, they would carry pigeons into the field with them, into the trenches, in wicker baskets, to send messages back to headquarters. Now, They attached messages to the first two pigeons. They were both shot down by German snipers.
Hmm.
Now, they attached one. All they had left was one pigeon, and that was Cher and Me. That was it. And it was that or certain death. And so they attached a message to headquarters saying, please rescue us. And he took off, and a German sniper hit him. Actually, he was hit by a barrage of bullets, and he started plummeting to earth. But just before he hit, whether it was pluck or valor or what have you, he started flapping his wings again and was soon out of rifle range. And when he arrived at headquarters about 20 minutes later, about 20 miles or more away, he arrived with, he was missing an eye, and his breastbone had been ripped open. And the message was dangling from tendons, which was all that was left of his leg. But, you know, the message was there. It got sent to the run to the commanding officer. The artillery fell silent. The lost battalion was saved. And actually, Cher and Me lived from this, to live to tell the tale, so to speak. And he was awarded tremendous honors, the French Croix de Guerre, which is the war cross. And he was met at the French harbor to be sent across to the U.S. on a troop ship. And he was met by a Pershing, and he was given Pershing's own personal berth on a ship. I mean, it's amazing when you look at these stories, and they're not that long ago. I mean, there were pigeons who did very similar acts of heroism in World War II. But you look how far, you know, how far we've come from that, where they decorated war veterans and celebrated, to being seen as winged vermin.
You know, I'm wondering about the ability of a pigeon. This pigeon, Cher and Me, was shot and wounded and yet still found his way back to his home base. And you were talking earlier about pigeons flying a long, long ways and finding their way back. How do they do that?
Well, you know, no one knows for sure. They're the top scientists around the country at all the universities, you know, top universities that have looked into this. But they do have a lot of theories. And one is they're able to use the sun and their position. They're able to know where they are, positioning themselves with the sun. The other thing they have is they have ultrasonic hearing, so they can hear wind rushing over the Rockies from maybe 2,000 miles away, which also helps them locate themselves. But a blindfolded pigeon will still find its way home, which is, just, I mean, let me say, a blindfolded pigeon will still find its way home. It'll take longer,
amazing.
But it will. And it's because they're able to sense the Earth's magnetic field, almost like a compass on the inside, and that'll get them home. But, you know, the funny thing is that the racers I talk to, everyone has a special story about a pigeon finding its way home. My favorite, I have a character in the book called Orlando, and he has a bird named Marty, and Marty never returns from a race. And she was his best bird, and he's surprised, he figures a hawk ate her. 2 weeks later, he opens his front door to leave the house, and there's Marty with a broken wing.
Oh.
She had walked home.
Oh, no.
That's an amazing story.
That is amazing. Now, you know, we tend to think of doves as being beautiful, but pigeons as being pests. Why do you think pigeons have descended to this bad reputation that they have? And are there some misconceptions that our listeners might have about pigeons that you'd like to rectify?
Yeah, I mean, if any bird needs or deserves a reassessment, it really is the humble pigeon. I mean, they're an extraordinarily gentle creature. I can't think of any other animal I'd let my two-year-old run around and chase. Now, the problem is most people don't know, and I actually didn't before I researched the book, what a pigeon really is. A pigeon is just a dove. People love doves generally for all the same human characteristic reasons. They're white, generally light-colored, and they're very, like, frail-boned or small-boned, more of a gentle, sculpted creature. But pigeons are rock doves. In fact, they originated in the cliffs of Asia, which is why you don't see, and they prefer to be on ledges still, which is why you don't see them nesting in trees ever. Now, it's the most interesting of the entire dove family. It's the only one that is domesticatable, and it's the only one that has this unparalleled history. It was a pigeon that brought news of Napoleon's defeat to Waterloo, to London, first word of it. And it was a pigeon that brought the first word of the very first Olympics in 776 B.C. In Greece, back to the villages.
Now, I should make full disclosure here. In the interest of good public radio and journalism, I need to confess to you, Andrew, that I have a barn, mm-hmm. and I have sheep. Mm-hmm. And in my barn, I have hay stored for the winter, because this is Wisconsin.
Sure.
And on that hay is a whole bunch of pigeon poop.
Yep.
And don't you think that's, I mean, tell you, the elephant in the room here, you know, our listeners are happy with biology. Isn't that part of the problem that people have with pigeons is that they are not the cleanest of creatures, and that they don't, like, use cat boxes or something like that,
yeah.
right?
The pigeon's problem is this. Basically, a pigeon suffers from two things. One is its gregarious nature. It likes to be around humans, and it likes to be around other pigeons. It's just a very friendly bird. So when they congregate, you know, their droppings are going to accumulate more easily. That really is the main issue here. And no, they don't have, you know, they don't have litter boxes. But, I mean, the fact is wildlife is inconvenient. And the question is, what do we do about it?
Yeah.
So in that instance, I would probably put just some netting around the area, and that would probably keep the pigeons off, or put a tarp over the area.
Well, you mentioned people trying to get rid of them, and cities like New York and London are constantly trying to get rid of pigeons that congregate in public places. How do you feel about their current methods of getting rid of those pigeons?
Well, I travel over a lot, you know, a lot of the world with this book, and studied others that I didn't visit. And I don't think any country is as brutal to the pigeon as we are. In China, they're revered. A lot of Muslim nations revere them. But in Europe, they use humane methods to control them by giving them public lofts, like hen houses, I guess you'd call them, and they cull the eggs there every week, so it controls the population. But Americans tend to go for caustic gels, and poisons, which is it doesn't work, and it's not humane.
And yet you found a lot of people who love pigeons. You mentioned one of your characters in the book, probably an expert, even though he was not an educated biologist. He certainly learned by observing and loved his birds.
Oh, these, I suspect you're referring to Orlando. And I have to say, the people who raise pigeons are really an interesting lot, and they're very much self-educated. Animal husbandry, you know, as I'm sure you know, can be very complicated. And these guys, you know, I've met pigeon racers who run around their backyard in soccer clothes and a whistle around their neck, you know, shouting orders at their pigeons and measuring the carbs and proteins that they consume the night before a race. Some of them even will massage their chest.
Oh.
I mean, or give them herbal teas that have eucalyptus in it, so it'll clear out their nasal passages.
I love it.
I mean, these are folks who are very, very intent about their birds. I mean, I find it fascinating.
Well, and you did a lot of great research for this book. Is there one thing that you found while researching this book that was particularly surprising?
Yeah, I have to say, I was just continuously blown away by how much I didn't know about the bird.
Mm.
I was surprised by how much I was surprised, is all I'd have to say. Now, granted, I am not a bird person. I do not run around the backyard with binoculars. I'm not even a pigeon person. In fact, when I started the project, I had no opinion about pigeons. But the more I came to learn about this bird's unparalleled history and athletic abilities, and its loyalty to the human race. I mean, I really grew to admire them. I can't look at a pigeon the same way.
Well, they're fascinating birds and a fascinating book. Andrew, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Andrew Bleckman is the author of Pigeons, the fascinating saga of the world's most revered and reviled bird. And he joined us today from his home in Dusseldorf, Germany. And if you'd like to join us, it's easy. Give us a call. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. Don't go away. Our animal trivia question of the week is next, with your chance to win your very own copy of Pigeons. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
This is Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, please give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and six winners will be selected at random to win an autographed copy of Pigeons by Andrew Bleckman. Here's today's question. In his book, Andrew Bleckman points out that the extinction of the passenger pigeon is the only instance in history when we know the exact time of a species extinction. The last passenger pigeon died in the Cincinnati Zoo on September 1st, 1914, at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. What was this female passenger pigeon's name? That's the question. And if you think you know the answer, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And to find out the answer to this week's question, we'll have it posted for you at callingallpets.org in about a week. But now we're ready to take some more calls, and let's take another call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name is Fred Mayer, and I'm calling you from Berryville, Arkansas.
Fred, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
You can help me solve a problem, I hope. I have pygmy goats, and I have Great Pyrenees dogs, which share a pasture. Unfortunately, they're also sharing the dog food, and I have pygmy goats now whose girth is greater than their length. So I guess my question to you, what we do, we have an automatic dog feeder, which sort of makes things easier with chores on the farm. I have a small farm, 12 acres, and so my question to you is there any place where a Great Pyrenees will go where a goat will not, so that we can continue to use the automatic dog feeder and can hopefully reduce my dog food bill so that I only feed dogs and not goats?
I have a two-letter word answer for you on that one. N-O. No, I don't
figured.
Know for sure. Patricia, what do you think?
No, Larry is absolutely right. You regrettably, the structure, anatomy, and behavior of the two species in question are the reverse of what you want, because, believe me, a goat can get a lot of places a Pyrenees could never get, but a Pyrenees can't get a lot of places a goat could get. So, for example, if the problem was reverse, you could have the food elevated up on top of, you know, a sort of high table or somewhere that a goat could jump into, but that a Pyrenees couldn't. But the problem is, the problem goes the other way around.
The other way around.
So there might be something, but frankly, I, for the life of me, can't think of what it is. Maybe our listeners can send us ideas. Send it to pets@wpr.org. Help this guy out. But frankly, I think you're just going to be stuck feeding the dogs twice a day, just taking it out there. And by the way, I had the same problem. I was shocked when my sheep were thrilled to eat the dog food that I left out for my dogs. Now, one thing you might want to think about is what kind of food is actually in the dog food. You know, the corn is, if you feed some kind of a corn-based carbohydrate in the dog food, that's going to be of particular interest to the goats. But we know goats are quite eclectic.
Yeah, they'll eat anything.
In terms of what they like to eat. So I would imagine no matter what kind of dog food, whether high or low quality you fed your dogs, the goats are still going to want it. I think you're just going to have to add that to your farm chores.
Well, it looks like it, and I see that you guys have the same answer as everyone else around here. So I guess
it's time to accept
the reality.
You're just stuck.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Fred. Thanks a lot for calling. Oh, boy. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Sometimes we don't always have advice that works, but other times we do. And Tricia, we received an update from Bob in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, who called into our program a while back, and I thought you might like to hear this.
I would love to get an update.
He says, I called last year to ask about my dog Sasha, a 45-pound short-haired pointer shepherd mix who's a Hurricane Katrina rescue dog, and I told you that our vet had discovered on X-ray some buckshot in her thigh muscle, which we believe led to her sort of manic reaction to any popping noises. You suggested giving Sasha a pheromone collar and introducing her to gradually increasing popping sounds. And you know what? 6 months later, I'm here to tell you that it all worked.
Oh, that's great.
Although she still reacts to sudden popping sounds, Sasha is no longer overwhelmed with panic. And the other night, I accidentally dropped a plastic cup on the ceramic floor about 5 feet from her, something that would have sent her to the cage for hours just 6 months ago, and this time she only ran about 5 feet away and turned back to check my reaction and see where the noise came from. So that was miraculous. In the 15 months that Sasha has lived with us, she's gone from a skittish, frightened dog to a well-adjusted, happy girl who is relatively fearless and playful. She now adores our bigger dog, and she loves to play and dig holes at the neighborhood dog park. Thanks to talking with you, Sasha has become a very active and beloved member of the family. On her behalf, thank you.
Well, and thank you for giving us an update, and thank you for rescuing this very needy dog. What an inspiration for people who are thinking about getting a dog from a shelter, right, Larry?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And your advice was pretty good as well.
I'm glad it helped. It's very gratifying. It's very reinforcing for us, just like chocolate.
I'd love to get some more updates from people, you know. We give advice every week, and it'd be fun to learn from others what's happened with the advice.
We would love to hear it. You know, every once in a while I run into somebody at a seminar out on the street, and I love hearing. Usually people say it helped. Every once in a while they say it didn't, but I love getting the updates. And you can send us an update. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to join in, of course, the number is 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Sandra in Madison, Wisconsin.
Sandra, hi. Thanks for calling.
Sure. Well, thanks for taking my call. We have two young golden retrievers, and our house has gone through a lot of changes. We had two geriatric dogs that passed away over time, over the past couple of years, and we kind of staggered having two old dogs and one puppy, and then two puppies and one old dog, and now we have a 2.5-year-old and a 1.5-year-old golden retriever.
Okay.
If you've seen the movie Jurassic Park, they're kind of like the two velociraptors at the end because they're just totally partners in crime.
Oh.
Just to kind of give you an idea of how these two work together, one of them will try to sneak into the front room and will grab stuffed animals for my kids and then pass it through the gate to the other dog, which will then run and sneak, and then the two of them will get together and they will destroy the stuffed animal. So the dilemma that we're having is, we have kids, and so it's hard to train dogs when you have kids, but how do you train your dogs to differentiate between their stuffed animals, what's okay for them to have and destroy, and what's our stuff?
That's a really tough one, especially for breeds of dogs who were bred to want to put something in their mouth.
Oh, and they love, something's always in their mouth.
And Goldens particularly seem to be one of those breeds that love plush toys. They love soft things in their mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So it is. There's no question about it. If you think about it, how could they possibly distinguish between a stuffed animal we bought at a pet store and a stuffed animal that we bought at a children's store? I mean, how could they possibly know, you know, like read the tag?
Right.
Right. So the best thing to do is have maybe one or two plush toys that are their toys. You play with them, you encourage them to play with them, and they will be able to distinguish a category, because a plush toy is always the same thing, and I only get to play with a big, round, brightly colored, fluffy football. You know, that's my toy. And every other plush, fuzzy toy of every other description is actually off limits. So if you're trying to teach them a distinction, you need to make the distinction very simple and very clear. So you get this toy and buy one that you can replace. You know, talk to the pet store people. It's like, is this going to go out of style in 6 months? You know?
Okay.
So that's one thing you can do. The other thing you can do is not allow them, and I actually have to do this myself because my dogs rip plush toys into shreds and then they start to eat what's inside and then they might eat the squeaker, which is really dangerous. So they only get plush toys when I'm there. And I control them. I don't leave them down on the ground ever. And I have a puppy right now who's learning, no, you can't jump on the guest room bed and take down the stuffed dogs on the bed in the guest room. And so that's the key, is if you're going to use plush toys, is figure out a distinction that's simple and clear that from a dog's perspective is going to make all the sense in the world without having to read the tag.
And then you're going to have to keep your kids' stuffed toys picked up, I assume.
Well, and I will leave the children training part to Larry because he has a 2.5-year-old, and we both know that's going to be the hardest part, right?
So I'll
pass that over to Dr. Mueller here because he has a little kid right now.
Well, we have a bunk bed for our only daughter, and the top of the bunk bed is completely filled with the stuffed toys.
But it's the top of the bunk bed, so she can't reach it.
Well,
there's one idea. You get a bunk bed, and all the stuffed toys go on the top, and only you can take them out, and the dogs can't.
Oh, thank you very much for calling, Sandra. Appreciate your call. And Patricia, thank you once again. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And we will be back in a week.
We sure will. I hope so, too. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director, and Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0811P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.
On the next Calling All Pets, we'll kick off our For the Love of a Dog topic series and find out if animals experience the same emotions as we do.
And we'll also talk with an author and long-distance swimmer whose early morning workout turned into a whale of an adventure.
Okay, tune in for that and answers to your animal behavior questions on the next Calling All Pets.